Millionaire Janitor by Lauren Bergstresser. Read for you by Deanna Sarkar. Chapter 1. Cradle of Dreams and Despair. In the heart of South Chicago, where the streets normally echoed with the rhythm of life and the pulse of the city, a miraculously normal event unfolded on a bitterly cold February night. It was a night when the frost seemed to cling to the air, weaving its icy tendrils through the alleys and around the corners of the modest buildings that lined the streets. To call the rows of identical duplexes modest is, to be accurate, an exaggeration of their attractiveness. Realistically, the entire neighborhood may well have been described, at best, as middle-lower class. Many, in more affluent districts, would have referred to the environs as the slums. Yet, even there, life went on. Honest people were eking out an honest living. The dishonest were doing what dishonest people do. Not that different from their richer fellow Chicagoans. In the midst of this wintry and somewhat depressing tableau, aided by the local midwife, and following the normal 9 months during which the child prepared for birth, a new person became visible to the world. Horatio Alger Jefferson let out a cry as he took his first breath in a world blanketed in snow, his arrival marking a moment of both joy and uncertainty. His mother, Emily Jefferson, a 17-year-old girl of petite stature but immeasurable strength of character, welcomed her son into the world with a mixture of mother's love, awe, and determination. Emily named her son as she did, remembering her enjoyment of the works of the famous novelist in her 10th and last year in school. Alger's stories of rags to riches had always fascinated Emily. Emily herself had experienced traumatic early teen years, her parents, Paul and Stella, having both died within a year of each other. Paul and Stella had been pillars of integrity in their community. That honorable quality showed itself in their raising of little Emily. "Sure, Emily, we are poor, and we'll never be able to live in Edison Park or dine at Mastro Steakhouse, but we are blessed to have what we have." And then her father would say, "Emily, don't ever succumb to the dogma of victim theology. Government is not God, so don't depend on it." And another of her father's favorite sayings was, "Keep on the right track and it'll all turn out for the best." Paul had been a plumber, and while on the job, had been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Suffice it to say, he was caught in the crossfire. Some months before Paul's sudden death, Stella had been diagnosed with cancer. She died just 360 days after her husband's passing. Emily was left on her own, without siblings, but with a determined will to survive. At times, though, she wondered about her dad's, "It'll all turn out for the best." Mother and father had invested both love and practical knowledge into the life of their little girl. The small home her parents had purchased 10 years earlier became Emily's. She had been only 14 at the time. Two kindly ladies from social services had arrived at her door and interviewed her shortly after her mother's funeral. Their intent had been to place her in a foster home, but when speaking with her, they quickly realized that they were dealing with a young lady who, in terms of maturity and ability, was far beyond her years. They then showed up from time to time. The checkups initially were spaced in 3-week intervals. After that, however, they checked in with her quarterly, once again when she was 15 and a half, and then not at all. Her parents had left her enough in their wills to enable her to exist for about 16 months. Although her widowed Aunt Georgina, who lived somewhere in the country, had offered to take her in, Emily declined, as her aunt had only sons, two of whom were Clive and Rattick. Their reputations were not impeccable. In fact, these older two appeared to have acquired ill-gotten gains that could not possibly have been earned on the back street bicycle shop where they claimed to work. The youngest son, Wolfie, Emily's age, always made the hair on the nape of her neck stand up when she was alone with him. Good-hearted Aunt Georgina was able, however, to provide Emily a small monthly allowance. "Until you can get on your feet." This was a big help for Emily, as her inheritance would run out quickly. It had been about 2 years after Stella's death when 23-year-old Jarvin Grimshaw, white trash as some of his darker-skinned neighbors called him, had shown up, showing sympathy and what she really believed was love. She knew nothing of his background, except for the lies he told her. Not only was he handsome, but he also said all the right things. Emily was alone in the world, and, in a moment of weakness, fell for his charm. In light of the tragic death of her parents and the resulting trauma, he promised to stand by Emily's side through thick and thin, but upon discovering the news of her pregnancy, had fled Chicago for parts unknown. He was never heard from again, at least not directly. Apparently, Aunt Georgina did know something of Jarvin's whereabouts. He'd gotten along well with Clive and Rattick. Some years later, shortly before she passed away, she told Emily that Jarvin had moved to Sebring, Florida. He had worked for a while at the Sebring Raceway, where, unfortunately, he had arrived at the site under the influence and had stumbled, falling into the path of a vehicle speeding into a pit stop in the middle of the 11th hour of the 12 hours of Sebring event. Apparently, he had left two wives to mourn his passing. There were rumors of a third, but that possibility had never been officially documented. Jarvin left no inheritance for either wife, or for his four children in Greenville, Mississippi, or for the two in Jacksonville. Jarvin had, when occasionally employed earlier, been a truck driver, absent from home for lengthy periods of time. Left to navigate the tumultuous journey of motherhood alone, Emily faced a future fraught with obstacles and uncertainties. Horatio's entrance into the world was, obviously, not without its challenges. Adding another layer to their story, Emily and Horatio were not only bound by their familial ties, but also by the unique circumstances of their environment. As Caucasians in a predominantly black neighborhood, they stood out amidst the sea of darker faces that populated their community. Their presence, a rarity in the vibrant tapestry of South Chicago, served as a constant reminder of the artificial, but nevertheless real, divisions that existed within their society. Despite the challenges that lay ahead, Emily held her newborn son close, her love for him a beacon of hope amidst the poverty that surrounded them. Together, mother and child embarked on a journey filled with trials and triumphs, their bond serving as a testament to the resilience of the human spirit in the face of adversity.